Hello, and welcome to episode 569 of Geek's Guide to the Galaxy. I'm David Barr Kirtley, author of the book Save Me, Please, and Other Stories. Publishers Weekly says, visceral settings and robust characters will have readers marveling at how much Kirtley's able to fit into a limited page count. For SFF fans with no time to sink into a doorstopper, these concentrated doses of genre goodness will hit the spot. And Kirkus Reviews writes, Kirtley employs sharp, concise prose that complements his puckish sense of humor. The author's passionate voice breathes life into this wonderful array of tales. So again, the book is called Save Me, Please, and Other Stories, and it's available now on Amazon.com. And our guest today is Lionel Shriver. She's the author of more than a dozen novels, including The Mandibles, The Motion of the Body Through Space, and Should We Stay or Should We Go? And her 2003 novel, We Need to Talk About Kevin, was adapted into a feature film starring Tilda Swinton, Ezra Miller, and John C. Reilly. And in this interview, we'll be discussing her new novel, Mania, about a world in which calling another person stupid is considered a hate crime, and her nonfiction book, Abominations, selected essays from a career of courting self-destruction. And now here's her interview with Lionel Shriver. All right, so we're here with Lionel Shriver. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Or not exactly.
Okay, so in your book, Abominations, you talk about how as a young writer, you moved to Belfast basically because people were setting off bombs there. So tell us about that.
Well, I moved to Belfast because I had an idea for a book that I wanted to set there. And I didn't realize until I arrived how trite that was. There had been many novelists before me coming to set books in Belfast. Clearly, the fact that it was a political hotbed was part of the attraction. But I also arrived with a funny political innocence. That is, I didn't have any preconceived political notions about who was on the right side in that conflict. In fact, I don't think I understood it in the slightest. So I only started studying the Troubles and what they were about once I was there.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting in the book because you say Northern Irish nationalists basically invented identity politics. So what do you mean by that?
Everything that's been happening in the last 10 or 15 years has been strangely familiar to me. The nationalists, by the time I arrived there, and those are the people who want a united Ireland, had evolved way beyond the initial civil rights struggle that the conflict started out as, and had become, I can only say whiny, super touchy, hypersensitive about language and the names for things, always on the lookout for offense. They had a victim complex. They were very attached to being victims, and they used being a victim as a weapon. And I hope that all sounds familiar.
And that really turned you off, I would imagine, just encountering that sort of
whininess.
For the first time.
Whininess is never attractive. And nor is weaponized victimization. And it also the use of weakness. Again, as a weapon, it's a little underhanded. And I think that we see that in politics today, that people are using being at a disadvantage to their advantage. So everything gets flipped on its head. A good example of this is I think now accurate perception on behalf of white men as a group, that they are to a disadvantage culturally and even in employment and admission to universities, et cetera. So that because they're so advantaged ostensibly, they are disadvantaged.
Mm-hmm. It was striking to me because you say this essay was written in 1997, and you say that in Belfast, that friendships fall apart because of political arguments, and you say that that doesn't happen elsewhere. And obviously that's changed dramatically since then. So it was sort of an interesting look into a completely different time reading that article.
Yes, living in Belfast was a taste of today. It had that same hyper-politicization. Everything was political. Everyone had to have a position on the border, you know, whether you wanted a United Ireland or wanted to stay in the UK. And it was very tribal, so that the divisions had become quite separated from the actual arguments for either of those political positions. It was whose side you were on. And that starts getting in the way of relationships unless you perfectly agree on everything. And again, there's a weird parallelism now. My new book, Mania, specifically looks at a friendship that starts to fray and finally fall apart because of political differences. And I think that is become a commonplace social problem, that people who have known each other for years, if not decades, and you know, have been in each other's homes, prepared each other dinner, gone to each other's weddings, etc. And suddenly, there's some political difference that one party or the other cannot forgive. And these long-lasting friendships are severed. And I am afraid that they're not usually put back together. Even if the political issue dissolves into nothingness, I think that the damage done to the friendships is permanent. This is also a problem in families.
Yeah, and we'll definitely get to Mania in just a second. I do want to talk to you, though, about this period. This fascinates me, sort of the 90s and before, when things weren't so fraught with politics. And you say, for example, in the book, you say, being a novelist in the era of call-outs for supposedly offensive content is far less fun than it once was. So just talk a little bit about what was it like being a novelist in the fun times when before the internet?
Before the internet, before the whole woke revolution, you know, a novelist was, dare I say it, an artist. I didn't have any sense of constraint. I felt free to write about whatever I wanted. The only risk was, of course, writing a bad book. That's always the biggest risk. You know, taking on something I couldn't handle or, you know, just somehow failing artistically. But I didn't sense that there were guide rails around me, that there were limits to the kind of character I could write or the kind of plot that I could take on. For example, in my first novel, I invented a fictional African tribe. I don't think that would be allowed today. And while, just because I'm perverse, I might allow myself to do it, I would do so knowing that I was breaking the rules and that I was going to get it in the neck for breaking those rules. And that would change what it felt like. It wouldn't be as innocent. Whereas when I crafted that African tribe, it was just fun. I didn't think that it was dangerous. And now I take on a lot of subjects that I know are going to be potentially troublesome, if not capable of ending my career. I mean, we're living in that kind of a world now.
Right. I mean, because when I was a kid, what I imagined being a writer would be like is like the worst thing that could happen would be maybe your book doesn't sell or you get a bad review, which I just imagined would be devastating, but that almost all the feedback you would get would be fan letters, because, you know, who cares enough to send you a letter for the most part, other than people who really like what you're doing. So, you know, I just had this idea that being a writer would mostly be positive feedback, you know, mostly adulation, is sort of how I imagined it in my head.
Oh, well, that's probably naive even for that period. I don't think anyone who is writing today imagines that they're only going to get positive feedback. There are so many sources of dislike out there. to the point where I find myself insulating myself from them. I am not on social media. And that there are a lot of reasons for that. Time, for one thing. Social media is a huge time suck. But it's also to protect myself. I don't necessarily want to be subjected to everyone's opinion of what I am doing. And if you put yourself in the way of enough negative feedback, I think it's inhibiting. Like you become too aware of your audience, therefore have to battle cautiousness, anticipating the kind of criticism you might be attracting. If you're at all insecure, you put yourself in danger of deciding, well, this isn't worth it. You know, I don't seem to be communicating. I'm constantly being misinterpreted. You know, therefore, what I'm writing isn't working because it's not sending the message I intend to send. And this is making me feel bad. And I quit. I can see that happening. And I wouldn't want that to happen to me. And maybe it's cowardly. I'm willing to entertain that my being off social media is so self-protective that it's, you know, oh, I guess I can't take it. But maybe I can't, and maybe I don't want to. Maybe most of all, I don't want to. You know, when you write stuff and put it out there, there's always a certain risk to it. You're exposing yourself in some way, and I don't want to court having it blow up in my face, or you know, walking out the front door and being slaughtered with a bunch of rotten tomatoes. I mean, I just, and I, you know, if you can get away with it, I would commend staying off social media for all creative writers.
I mean, just to give people an idea of what we're talking about. So you say in the book, at the 2016 Sewanee Writers Conference in Tennessee, fellow authors accused Alan Weir of a microaggression because three old men in a baseball park ogled a young woman in his short story. I can see how just repressive and how that would make you not want to attend writers' conferences, honestly.
Which I don't. Which I really don't. I thought that was hilarious. But it's quite illustrative of what's been going on for the last 15 years. It used to be that in fiction, you had plausible deniability. That is, if you had a narrator, it was not necessarily speaking for the author. If you have characters having a conversation, those characters are discreet. They can say whatever that character would say, and it doesn't mean that that the author is endorsing their opinions. And that's no longer the case. Anything that appears in your book, you get held responsible for politically. And that is very constraining. And I don't adhere to that. I still write in such a way as to assume that I have that plausible deniability that we used to take for granted. But I know that when I put dangerous opinions in the mouths of my characters, I am at risk myself. That those quotes can be taken out of context, and a reviewer or a commenter online will not necessarily say, oh, that was a character saying that. That will get imputed to me.
The other thing from Abominations I really was curious to ask about is you talk about how your father was a preacher and he once literally dragged you by your hair to make you go to church, and that you just always were just always not convinced by religion, just from, I think, basically as early as you can remember. Could you talk about just what was that experience like, and how did that shape your outlook?
Yes, I grew up in a professionally religious household. That's not to say it was all that oppressive as these things go. It was a democratic, liberal household. So it was a form of Presbyterianism that was very socially involved, you know, against the Vietnam War, concerned about world poverty etc. But there wasn't any choice given to us three kids as to whether or not we were going to believe in Christianity, and we were certainly not given a choice in whether or not we went to church every Sunday. And this is an experience that a lot of younger people today don't have. Abundantly younger people in the West are brought up in secular households, and they don't understand what it's like to have a belief system imposed on them. And therefore, it doesn't seem very rebellious to decide you're not going to be a Presbyterian. It just, but it was hard in my household. It was hard with my parents, and I had to really put my foot down. And that was probably my first assertion of my capacity for independent thought. It was a critical separation from my parents. And I won't say they never forgave me. It wasn't that bad, but it was damaging to the relationship, and it was disappointing to my parents.
I thought it was interesting because you say that you have never written from the point of view of a deeply religious character, because it's just not something that you just can't get into that frame of mind, no matter how hard you try. And I would say I'm basically in the same boat as that, despite my best efforts. But talk about that, how you say it would be unfathomable to me to write a character with strong religious convictions.
Yes, I think you need, whatever character you're crafting, you need some kind of access to them. You know, you have to understand them in some sense. Even if it's a so-called bad character, that they have to seem plausible to you on an interior level. And I don't know what it feels like to believe in God. I don't quite get it. And I really mean this as a weakness. This is not a boast. I do not understand religious faith, especially when it involves attaching oneself to what is a patently implausible story. And that separates me from a lot of the world.
Right, because I've tried so hard, because I meet people who are obviously incredibly smart, and you know, it's just an objective fact that they're incredibly smart, but they're also religious. And just no matter how hard I try, I just cannot follow the train of logic for, okay, there are these scientifically impossible stories that are thousands of years old, written by unknown persons that we know have been rewritten countless times by other unknown persons. I'm going to attach, you know, very strong significance to these stories. I can't, no matter how hard I try, I can't follow that chain of logic.
Oh, I had that same problem with my own parents. I still don't get why my father decided to go to seminary instead of to, you know, a university. Why he went to Harvard, but he went to Harvard Divinity School. I don't understand what process went through his head. He was a very capable person, very bright. This is what you're saying, right? Very intelligent people. And yet they believe these far-fetched stories. And I found myself at a funny junction lately. There are a lot of conservative thinkers who believe that one of the problems that Western society is going through right now is directly to do with having become so secular. And therefore, all of these people looking for a substitute religion end up fastening onto political ideologies with religious zeal. And I am sympathetic with that viewpoint. I can see how there is a kind of thirst, a kind of wandering in the wilderness, looking for direction and purpose, because people used to be raised to have a religion that also came with a moral belief system, you know, a firm understanding of right and wrong. And that was something that was shared. It was a communal experience. It wasn't just an individual one. And I think it is plausible that there is something in human beings that yearns for that kind of shared understanding of the world, even if it's a little nutty. And therefore, I kind of start coming full circle after having rebelled against Presbyterianism since I was 8 years old. Wondering if what I rejected had a value, or at least a great deal more value than I gave it at the time. Because when you're rejecting something, you're not looking for what its wonderful qualities are. You just think it's dumb. And I thought it was dumb. And now I look at, there are any number of principles in Christianity that are quite useful. For example, this whole idea that the sons do not inherit the sins of the fathers. I think that's a very important principle. And lately we're not applying it because heritable guilt has become quite fashionable. This whole idea of modern day Westerners having to pay reparations to modern day Black people for slavery when modern day Westerners had nothing to do with slavery and it's not their fault. I mean, that's all about heritable guilt. In fact, this whole business of being deeply ashamed of Western civilization altogether is all based on various sins of the past that the people of the present had nothing to do with and are in some ways just as victimized by as the victims of the past. So I you know, that's just one example, but I think there are elements of Christianity that have some real value, and I can't believe I'm saying this honestly.
Well, so this is a show for science fiction fans, and so one thing I wanted to ask you about is that several of your recent novels sort of tread the line with speculative fiction. So this new novel, Mania, it's set in an alternate timeline. The Mandibles is set in the future. You say that in your novel, Should We Stay or Should We Go? Some chapters veer into speculative fiction, cryogenics, a cure for aging. So I'm just curious, why do you think it is that some of these recent novels have moved more in that direction of towards speculative fiction?
Well, for one thing, I used to be a big science fiction fan. So I'm familiar with the genre. I haven't really kept up. There's probably a lot of great science fiction out there that I haven't read. I tend to read much more just standard contemporary fiction. But it's in my blood. You know, I read it during a formative period, during my adolescence. And, you know, all those stories are in the back of my head somewhere. And I would also observe that for someone my age, I'm 66 coming up on 67. Well, I was born into a world where, you know, the 2000s were abstract and far away and frankly, science fiction. You know, 2001 of Space Odyssey. That's still seen far in the future. My ability to imagine the present and keep up with the present is impaired. Like I always constantly feel behind. Occasionally when I'm writing a date, I want to write 19 instead of 20.
Yeah.
and when I remember it's 2024, it's almost like remembering your phone number or an address that you have to get to. It's become incredibly arbitrary and surreal. So I'm living, to me, my experience right now is living science fiction. And if you look at what's happened technologically in the last 25, 30 years, especially with the internet, I mean, that is science. That was the science fiction of my youth. So, you know, I feel as if I'm in some kind of hypothetical future all the time.
I mean, in these two books I read, some of the science fiction you mention is 2001, The Twilight Zone, Star Trek, Flowers for Algernon, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and Brave New World. Would you say so? Those were some of your favorites growing up, or are there other ones that you would name?
Yeah, I would throw that in the basket. But I also read a lot of the standards, Philip K. Dick or Harlan Ellison or Robert Heinlein, Arthur C. Clarke, the, you know, the canon.
Would you say that maybe part of the reason is that the present has become so absurd that in order to satirize it, that you have to kind of go push things further than you would have in the past?
Well, I think the challenge of the present is satire. It's very difficult to satirize it. It satirizes itself. And that's frustrating for a satirist, because you don't want someone else to do your job for you. It's hard to keep up with how absurd things have been getting, especially in the last 10 years. In some ways, yeah, I feel unneeded.
Well, so tell us about Mania. So as I said, it's set in this alternate timeline where you've created something called the Mental Parody Movement. So tell us about this timeline and the Mental Parody Movement.
Well, I started the book in an alternative 2011, and that was not an arbitrary choice, because I was responding to this series of what I perceive as social manias that have come lickety-split one after the other within about a 10 to 12 year period. The sudden obsession with transgenderism, the turmoil over Me Too, the copycatting of all those COVID lockdowns, the Black Lives Matter movement, which went international literally in a couple of days. And I'm a little worried we're in the midst of another one with the what I would have to call over-the-top climate alarmism. So I decided that I would get in behind all of these social hysterias and make up my own. And that way I wouldn't have to address any of those in particular, because I was more interested in the larger phenomenon. My mania is that it suddenly seizes the entire Western world. This idea that there is no such thing as variable human intelligence, that everyone is equally smart, and discrimination on the basis of intelligence is the last great civil rights fight. So you can't call anyone dumb anymore, and you can't keep from hiring someone or letting someone into your university just because they're pig thick. And that's the kind of language that you're not allowed to use anymore. And that's the background of the book. And then in the foreground is this friendship between two women who've known each other since high school and gradually get in on opposite sides of the mental parody movement.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about these main characters. So you've got Pearson and Emery. Kind of how did you come up with those characters, and why did you want to use them as the lens to tell this story?
Well, Pearson is unabashedly something of an exaggeration of myself. Pearson didn't just grow up Presbyterian. She grew up Jehovah's Witness. And that is an especially oppressive religion. It's unusually joyless. It's very controlling. I think it's particularly unpleasant for children. It doesn't let you celebrate birthdays or Christmas or pretty much any holiday. And you can only have friends who are in the church. And Pearson hated it and finally put her foot down when she was 16. But the only way to put your foot down in this case was to leave. And when she left her family and started living with her best friend's family, her family never spoke to her again for the rest of her life, which is pretty hard to take. So I felt that I came up with a character who had been wounded, not just wounded, but wounded by dogmatism, and who had therefore achieved an absolute allergy to dogmatism. So when the mental parity movement comes along, she recognizes the same repressive qualities and the same controlling qualities of the religion that she grew up with, and is immediately repelled by it. Her best friend Emery is she's a slicker number. Pearson's a little socially inept. She's constantly doing things that end up being self-destructive, whereas Emery has great social antennae. She always knows which way the wind is blowing, and she knows how to act in her best interest. So when a new ideology comes along, she knows how to use it to her advantage. Whereas, of course, Pearson's just going to end up setting herself against it and doing herself a terrible amount of damage, which, of course, is what happens in the book.
Yeah, and I think it's a fantastic novel. And, I mean, it just really captures the sort of repressive atmosphere that's existed in recent years, where nobody's sure what they're allowed to say, and people are, you know, as you mentioned, friendships are falling apart, and no one's sure who they can trust, or people are losing their careers over nothing or over very small things. And it just gave me, it sort of like gave me a lot of anxiety reading the book. I sort of had a sick feeling in the pit of my stomach. Did you feel that way writing it? Like, was it challenging to write because it's dealing with such, you know, such sort of anxiety-inducing things?
No. My text doesn't induce anxiety in me. I think it may induce anxiety in a lot of other people because it sometimes aimed at them. No, I had a wonderful time writing this book. It was hilarious. I made myself laugh aloud all the time. I had a great time with the language because there's this whole raft of language that you can't use anymore. You can't even be dumbfounded because you can't use the word dumb anymore. And so I put together a whole list of words that you wouldn't be able to use. You can't even use the word reflective because it implies that there are some people who think more about the world than others, and that's discriminatory. But it also means that you can't cite reflective tape. So that part of the book is quite light, although if you've ever seen Stanford University's list of harmful language, you'll realize that my list isn't exaggerated at all. You can't even, you know, you're not even supposed to use the word field because it's going to remind Black people of slavery. Not even a field of study.
So would you say it was cathartic writing this book?
Yes, I would. It was a way of making fun of the present. I managed to stay away from the present by just about a millimeter or two. It's very clear that I am taking aim at what's going on right now. I mean, it's a little bit like what I've always said about science fiction. The science fiction is secretly, it may be set in the future or something, but it's always about the present. It's making a point about the present. So that's unquestionably what I'm doing in this book. But I hope it's done in a playful enough way that even slightly open-minded left-wingers can find it enjoyable.
I mean, so like there's references to the Crucible and the lottery in this book. Do you see this as being kind of in the vein of those kinds of stories?
Yes. Yes, I would say that's a good comparison because, of course, Pearson ends up being something of a martyr, and like a lot of martyrs, to no avail, right? So she suffers, in the end, great personal ignominy and loses everything, but it doesn't do any good. And that is the case for an awful lot of swimming against the tide. I'm afraid that I find a lot of opposition in the thick of a social mania doesn't end up earning you any brownie points or doesn't end up redounding to your advantage.
Well, and unless we give listeners the impression that this book is just a complete downer, I mean, it does have, I don't want to give away too much, but there was kind of an interesting twist, maybe a couple toward the end. So
yes,
it's not just unrelieved misery all the way through.
Oh, it's not meant to be miserable. In fact, it should be a huge amount of fun. I think that the relationship and the way that it starts to fray and decay will be something that any number of readers recognize from their own lives. And that the kind of purity demanded on the left is destroying relationships, because, you know, and it just doesn't have a very good effect on people. The whole woke thing, and I don't know what else to call it. It makes people tiresome. It makes them say the same thing all the time and the same thing as everyone else, and nothing about them is surprising. And you can predict their opinion on not on just one or two things, but on everything. It's a really tedious and humorless time. And for people who do have a sense of humor and who do have a creative turn of mind and are capable of independent thought, it's quite trying. And we just keep waiting for it to be over. And I'm afraid it's lasting a lot longer than we expected.
Well, and I'll just explain for listeners. I mean, people might have a certain sense of your politics from your public reputation or whatever. But in the book, these are some of your left-wing opinions. You say, you're a lifelong Democrat who cried when Trump got elected. You're pro-choice, support same-sex marriage, are in favor of gun control, support single-payer health care, and would decriminalize assisted suicide, prostitution, and recreational drug use. So, you know, I just feel like people might not have a full picture of what your views are if they didn't read Abominations, for example.
Yes, that's because we have these rigid categories into which everyone has to fit. And I'm afraid I don't fit very easily into the categories that we are functioning with now. You're either completely all in with what is really an extreme left position, or you're far right. So I sometimes get tossed in with far right, and I have a lot of people simply assuming that I supported Trump. In fact, last election, I voted for Biden. You know, I've never supported Trump. So, you know, the rigidity with which we approach each other now means that we often completely misunderstand each other. And I would regard myself as widely misunderstood. I have a couple of positions that are not routinely liberal. I am not happy about mass immigration, uncontrolled mass immigration. And that's made me especially unpopular. But that's a position I will own. The other position I've taken, which I will also own, is that I do not like affirmative action. Affirmative action came in when I was about 16 years old in the early 70s, and I didn't like it then, and I've never changed my mind. I think it's destructive of relationships between the races. I think it actually increases racism because it implies that certain groups need special help. And I don't think it's succeeded in leveling the playing field as it was supposed to. It's also, apparently, once you bring it in, permanent. You'll never get rid of it. So those are the positions I think that have especially alienated my liberal readers. But can't we agree to differ on a few things?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the one that sort of I had heard the most about, you know, my wife was in an MFA program a few years ago, and one of the professors assigned your novel, We Need to Talk About Kevin. And apparently the whole class just has devolved into a whole thing about what an awful person you are. And
So it was actually kind of surprising for me to the speech that you gave that set off all the hoopla was in this book. And I just reading it, it seems pretty normal to me. I mean, you could agree or disagree with it, but it doesn't seem, I don't see why it's something that would have occasioned the level of outrage than it did.
Yeah, that speech in Brisbane in 2016 had a reaction that I didn't anticipate at all. I was mostly worried that maybe my point was so obvious that it would be boring and I would disappoint the audience. Instead, it became an international scandal. That was the point at which I realized that something was going a little nuts, because what I was saying was so mild that basically, you know, we have to be free to appropriate each other's cultures if we're going to experience real freedom as fiction writers. Fiction writers are thieves, right? They're natural thieves. They're pickpockets. And they take anything that's useful to them to make a story. That's the way it should be. And I think, you know, obviously, if you only allow people to write about their own experience, then all that's left is memoir. There is no fiction. There are no novels. So, to me, that seemed self-evident and yes, borderline boring. And for some reason, it was incendiary. And what made it especially incendiary, and this is widely misreported, if anything ever gets out that's wrong on the internet, you can be sure that it will stay wrong for eternity. It's always reported that during this entire speech, I wore a sombrero. Now, as it happened, the speech begins with an anecdote involving a group of students who got into terrible trouble for having a tequila party and wearing miniature sombreros. And suddenly this had become, you know, a cultural outrage. This was a cultural appropriation. So as a little flourish for the very last three words of the speech, I said, you know, we fiction writers have to wear many hats. And then I put it on, including a sombrero. That was it. And this was, you know, it's still touted. The New York Times and LA Times dragged out this story again as a terrible outrage, mistelling it. The reason that it irritates me that it's always reported that I wore the sombrero the entire speech is that would be bad showmanship, right? That's not the little flourish that I intended. It just makes me sound geeky. So I wouldn't, you know, I have a better sense of theater than that. So no, that's not the way I did it. But I find it out and out comical that just putting on a sombrero is regarded as some kind of, you know, what, great, egregious sin. I just think that's hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, I would encourage people just to read the speech for themselves and make up their own mind. As I said, it seemed pretty reasonable to me. But I mean, and also as I read your follow-up essay, there was essentially one person in the audience who took offense to it and then posted about it online. And then it got picked up by The Guardian. And that's what made it this international scandal. And it seems like if that one person hadn't been in the audience, nobody ever would have heard about this, which I think is part of the reason I wonder is all this just a consequence of technology? There's a line in Mania where one of the characters says, on the internet, everyone is powerful. And I kind of think of the creation of the internet and social media as like the invention of nuclear weapons. It just completely changes. It's a, you know, qualitative change in everything, not just a quantitative change.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Everyone is armed with nuclear weapons now. I think that's correct. And I also think it's correct that if that one person hadn't stomped out, and actually, I don't even think she stomped. I didn't even know she'd left the audience until somebody told me later. If she hadn't put out her indignant post, then maybe the whole thing would have blown over. It wouldn't have been a thing, as we say. However, I would have to say, ironically, that my career ultimately benefited from that occasion. I benefited from her walking out. I benefited from her posting her indignation. It hugely boosted my international profile. And, you know, it's a big world out there. I think we've got almost 8.5 billion people. It's hard to be noticed. So, you know, my career got more out of that than hers did. I don't think, last I checked, she wasn't doing so well. So I guess I was fortunate in a way. And it was only the internet that made that possible.
But I mean, it seems like, I mean, it could have easily destroyed your career if your career was in a more precarious position, right? And this is one of my frustrations with cancel culture, is it seems that people, it creates this hierarchy where people who have the financial resources and clout and prestige to weather an attack can often benefit from the publicity, but people who don't have that same level of wealth and prestige get completely run out of town and destroyed. And so it just seems like from a left-wing perspective, the last thing we want is a society in which the wealthier you are, the more free speech you have. And that it seems to me that that's exactly what cancel culture creates.
I agree. I think the real victims of this movement, if we can call it that, are people who have very little social power, very little career power. They're disposable. It doesn't cost anything to ruin their lives. That is, it doesn't cost other people that much to ruin their lives. And these are the people who are least likely to recuperate and to put something back together again. Whereas someone like J.K. Rowling can obviously afford to stick her neck out and to say, actually, there are only two sexes and you shouldn't put biological men in women's prisons. And that is also a kind of mild assertion and suddenly an outrage. And I don't want to sound ungrateful. I think she's been very useful, and I'm glad that she has taken a position on this, and she hasn't backed down, and she hasn't capitulated to the pressure to apologize. So that's been great. But you know, she's still standing because she makes her publisher a huge amount of money. So her publisher isn't about to turn around and say, "I'm sorry, JK, we're not publishing you anymore because you're bringing disrepute to the company." It's not going to happen. Whereas if she were just a first novelist who said the same thing, I think they would have booted her out. And I think this has happened to a lot of people. So I entirely agree that it is hypocritical to for people on the left who always imagine that they're sticking up for the weaker parties in the world, for them to pursue a protocol that most of all destroys the weak.
Right. So we're almost out of time. I live in Austin, so one thing I was kind of curious to ask you about is in Mania, there's a reference to this kind of like secret school with actual standards that arises in Texas by implication in Austin. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if that was inspired by the University of Austin, this new school in any way.
Absolutely. It was what we call an illusion. So yes, I'm glad you picked that up. I am encouraged by that project. I wish it the greatest success. And that was a kind of tribute on my part.
If people don't know, this is basically a new, they're trying to start a new college with a bunch of sort of heterodox thinkers that is hopefully going to be more receptive to a wide range of viewpoints than a lot of the colleges are now.
Yes, and they have attracted some pretty heavy hitters. I mean, Neil Ferguson is behind this, and you know, he's a considerable historian. And I think that in saying, oh, we're going to have standards for our student body. They've also set some pretty serious standards for their faculty.
I also wanted to ask you, so both Barack Obama and Andrew Yang appear as characters, very minor characters in this alternate timeline you've created. And I was just curious kind of what your take on them is and why you wanted to include them in this story.
Well, I've always had a soft spot for Obama. I don't really have the historical or political acumen to assess exactly how successful he was as a president in the scheme of things. But I've always found him personally winning. And in my alternative past, everything that contributes to that quality of suaveness and of intelligence is suddenly to his disadvantage. The fact that he's erudite, the fact that he speaks well and in complete sentences and uses a large vocabulary, and even his very stylishness becomes suspect because, of course, the mental parity movement, it rapidly becomes anti-intellectual. So in my version of the recent past, Obama is forced to call it quits after a single administration. And so in 2012, the Democratic Party runs Joe Biden instead. And that's because he is such a shining mediocrity. So I tried to change the past, especially to start with, only a little bit. And then you get to 2016, and the movement has further advanced. And therefore, you really need a candidate who is not just mediocre, but inarticulate, clumsy and boorish, preferably fat, uses the same words all the time, doesn't speak in complete sentences, is a little crude. Guess who runs for the Democratic Party? So, yeah, I hope people are getting the feel for it. I had so much fun with this book. It is in some ways, it's not super serious. It is not a heavy book. It is a fun book.
Right, but it's a provocative book, and it's a book that I feel like a lot of people would be afraid to write or would not be able to get published. And so it's sort of depressing to me as a book reviewer and critic, just, you know, the sense that so many people are walking on eggshells and just being overcautious. And it makes it sort of dreary to contemplate the new books that are coming out. So I just like the fact that there are books like this coming out where people are uninhibited in that way.
Yeah, I think caution makes for bad art. We don't see a lot of great fiction coming out lately. And I think it has partly to do with the fact that too many of my colleagues are terrified. And I've noticed a number of people sometimes taking refuge in historical fiction, so that you don't have to deal with any of the contemporary issues right now because they're too dangerous. And I wish my peers would grow a pair, as they say. Life's short, and you only have a brief period in order to get out there and make your mark and say something interesting. And if you're just conforming, then nobody's going to notice you. I mean, again, I think I have in the big picture benefited from the fact that I glaringly stick out. I mean, I'm not one more standard left-wing fiction writer churning out more books about how slavery was bad and we shouldn't be racist. I mean, yeah, right, slavery was bad. We shouldn't be racist. But I don't want a book hectoring me about that. It's not interesting to me. And I'm always looking to write books which fill a need. I want to write a book nobody has written before, making a point that isn't being made. And if all you're doing is repeating the shibboleths of the present, you might as well hang it up. There's no point. So people think I'm deliberately provocative. Well, in that sense, yes, I am. Because to just repeat mindlessly whatever it is we're supposed to believe this year means there is no reason to be doing this project. It needs to, you know, for me to write a book, it needs to be making waves in some way, making people think, or maybe making people angry. Maybe sometimes that's necessary, but I'll live with it.
All right. Well, I think that's a good note to end on. Do you have any other final thoughts or any other projects that you want to let people know about?
Well, my next book is going to be about immigration. So, frying pan to fire.
Do you think you'll write any more speculative fiction adjacent books?
Oh, that's always possible. I've really enjoyed it. One of the things I like about speculative fiction is that it allows for a lot of formal experimentation. And I'm never interested in formal experimentation for the sake of it, just to be different. But I do enjoy using form to a purpose. I mean, for example, in Should We Stay or Should We Go, a couple books ago, I had 12 different endings to the story. That was the book, is all the endings. And, you know, I was exploring a particular question as to whether or not a couple that had vowed to commit suicide once they reached the age of 80, should they have gone through with it or not? So it was very, very much to a purpose. But then I was able to use this device of the multiple endings to look at even into the far future. You know, once they were they to live to 100, what kind of future would you be looking at? So I love the traditions of science fiction, but I use them to a purpose. And as I said, in order to explore a question in the present.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I really enjoyed reading Mania and Abominations, and they definitely made me curious to check out as well The Mandibles and Should We Stay or Should We Go? So maybe I'll get to those next. But we are all out of time, so we're going to have to wrap this up there. So we've been speaking with Lionel Shriver about her new book, Mania. So Lionel, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
And that was our interview. So big thanks again to Lionel Shriver for joining us on the show. Geek's Guide to the Galaxy is made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. So if you enjoy the show and want it to continue, please support us on Patreon over at patreon.com/geeks or via PayPal over at geeksguideshow.com/crowdfunding. All right, so that was our show. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.